Right, so I'm guessing this audio is working. Put your hand up if the audio is working. This thing's going to freak me out. I don't usually do quiet. Okay, so welcome to DPP 405. My name's Chris Auld. I'm from sunny New Zealand. Who are the other New Zealanders in the audience? Oh, there's a handful of us. Bloody good. I'm from a place called Intergen. And my Twitter tag's just there. So I thought I'd keep Twitter open and we can maybe try and have a little bit of interactivity on Twitter throughout the presentation. We will try and make a little bit of noise later on too, which I'm sure will get me in a hell of a lot of hot water. But just for shits and giggles, I think that'll be pretty good. Quick show of hands, who's played with DocDB already? Oh, not many, okay. What about something else, like maybe a Mongo, handful, Raven? Something else weird, like some other weird document store. Couch, yeah. So those would be the biggies. Bloody good. Okay, well, so topic of today is really to try and deep dive a bit into Microsoft's new Azure DocDB service. I am aiming for a reasonably deep session, so I'm not going to try and do too much sort of lap around content. But we will have a bit of a sort of a refresher. I'm going to drop my sample app at the end of the session up onto Twitter and I think up onto the Yammer space for this session. And that'll cover a whole lot of stuff that I'm not going to necessarily touch on in this presentation. So let's start with sort of a primer on DocDB. And one of the interesting things about Azure is everything seems to get announced these days by a blog post by Scott Goo. There's sort of, you know, that's kind of the official announcement channel, which is good in some ways and bad in others. There was a whole lot of new stuff that landed just this morning. So we might touch on that, we might not. Anybody played with that yet? No one yet. So there's a bunch of new portal stuff and things. So let's have a bit of a primer on DocDB. So DocDB is a fully managed, highly scalable, NoSQL document database service. What the hell does that mean? So it is a JSON document store. It stores hierarchical JSON documents, JSON being a serialization of a JavaScript object model. And it is a schema-free storage mechanism. Now that means we don't need to sort of a priori tell the database engine the structure of the documents that we're going to be storing. It's unique in that it's schema-free not just in regards to data storage, but also schema-free in regards to indexing. And that's a really, really important thing, and we're going to drill into that in quite a bit of detail shortly, so I'm not going to touch on it too much here. It is transaction aware, so the service itself allows you to make a call up to the RESTful endpoint, and then operations that you perform on the data store within that call are encompassed within an atomic transaction. Doesn't support multi-statement transactions insofar as sort of multiple calls to the data store, but within that one call, you can execute JavaScript and so forth, and within the context of a collection, have all of those operations be performed atomically. It's a write-optimized database, so it is designed for extremely high write throughput. Ultimately, the data is stored onto SSDs, and it's tunable by you in terms of configuring indexing, and we're going to go into that in some detail, and also configuring the consistency model that you want for your database, because all of these NoSQL stores tend to use a replicated data model where your data is stored in multiple copies within the data center. And for most of them, you can make some decisions about how you want those replicas to be kept updated, and in doing so you trade off some latency in terms of, you know, how quickly do the calls return to you, and some consistency. If you've got three replicas and you have strong consistency, right, it's going to take longer than if you have weak consistency and you say just update one replica and go and update the rest of them asynchronously. And again, we'll drill into that a bit later on. And the most important thing is that this has been built from the ground up to be deployed and delivered on an as-a-service basis. All right, so it's not shipping at the moment in any sort of on-premises form. It's been delivered as a service out of Azure. All right. You pay for it as you use it, so you buy it in small increments. And it's really good for achieving fast time to value because it's very easy for us to build applications against it. That JSON object model means that we can, in some application cases, actually use JavaScript for the entirety of our app. Right? So you're thinking HTML and JavaScript on the client side, you're thinking, say, Node.js on your sort of your app tier, and then executing JavaScript and storing JSON in your data tier. Are there any like super JavaScript enthusiasts here? No. No one will admit to it? Right. I did a really cool re-implementation of the marquee tag for one of the demos that I did at another conference recently, because I'm kind of that age in terms of JavaScript. Okay, so DocDB in one slide. So DocDB services itself as a RESTful web service. Right? That means that we have addressable resources within the database, and we perform HTTP actions against those with the verb and the body payload of our request, fit to be representing our call into the service. So that means that we can access this from pretty well any client technology that supports HTTP. And that's pretty well anything. There are supported libraries from Microsoft for Node, .NET, Python, JavaScript, and I think some Java stuff coming. And ultimately, it's about dealing with our database in this resources-based model. So we create a database account. Within that account, we define databases. And then databases consist of collections. And the collection is probably the more important sort of demarcation point even than the database, because it's at the collection level that we start applying the resources that we buy from Microsoft to really drive our databases. So collections help us deal with scale out, and they really are our unit of scale. And they also provide the mechanism that we use for durability. So in terms of replicating this data in the data center and defining our consistency level. So you know, collections are probably the most important thing to think about. You can think of a database really just as sort of a grouping of collections. DocumentDB provides granular access control. Right? So we have item level permissions defined on the resources such as documents, attachments, and so forth. And it has a tokenization mechanism that we can use to generate permissioned tokens for users to be able to access those resources. So it does have its own authorization mechanism built into the store. It has a mechanism for dealing with attachments, and I'm not going to go into this in detail now because we talk about it a bit later, but this is really important when you think about the idea that DocDB is using SSD for storage. SSD is quite an expensive way of storing data. Often when we're dealing with this data, we're going to store things like binary large objects, images, large chunks of text, and so forth. It probably doesn't make sense to stick those onto expensive storage if we're not actually going to use them for indexed retrieval of our data. We'd probably put them somewhere else. The challenge with many of these models, and this is a pretty common model in Azure already, is if we go and put them somewhere else, we've got to deal with all of the mucking around in terms of life cycle of those various objects. So DocDB has a mechanism to support us in doing that. It has T-SQL-like programmability. And some people will go, that's fantastic. And some people will go, stored procedures are the devil incarnate. Let's have a quick show of hands. So who are enthusiasts about data tier programmability? Who thinks data tier programmability is the devil incarnate? Oh, so about 50-50, fantastic. We might have to have a little sort of showdown at the end of the session. We will drill into this a little bit later. I'll explain why I think it's a good idea. As a customer, you buy storage and throughput capacity on an account-by-account basis and then apply that to the collections within your account. And so that's probably the first thing we'll talk about, is drilling down a bit into how we how we buy the resources that run our database. So this is delivered as a service in Azure. So the first thing we do is we jump on the Azure portal and we provision up one or more database accounts. And then within that database account, we can purchase 1 to 5 capacity units. If you think you need more than 5 capacity units, it is very much a soft boundary. You can call up the team and say, I'd like to have some more, please. I'm sure they'd be more than happy to sell it to you. If you need a contact into that team, just ping me on Twitter or on email. A capacity unit is a reserved chunk of storage in gigabytes, and throughput. And that throughput is basically the operations that you can perform against the data store. And that throughput is delivered to you in a thing called request units that are they're abstract to you, but they are deterministic in terms of providing us with a mechanism that we can use to capacity plan for our data store. And that probably contrasts a little bit with some other services in Azure that have, you know, for quite a wee while been non-deterministic. And if you've been to TechEd a few times and heard me present a few times, you would have heard me present about Windows Azure SQL Database. And that shipped originally the other way, right? So that shipped with non-deterministic performance. And that was a positive for some people's applications and negative for other people's applications. And they're just going through a process now of moving that to a more deterministic model. So DocumentDB is deterministic in terms of performance. And those request units give us a deterministic measure of the throughput in our application. So we buy these capacity units at the account level, and those capacity units are then allocated across the collections that we have inside that database account. And we basically allocate those for between a third and a whole capacity unit per collection. So you know, I think of if you've got one capacity unit, it can basically support up to 3 collections, with each collection having a third of that. And that storage is allocated automatically, so you don't necessarily have to have completely equi-sized amounts of data within each of your collections. But you are subject to a minimum of 3.3 gigs per collection. So if you are, you know, if you're using significantly under that, you are, you know, in effect wasting money. And then your throughput, right, again, is allocated across collections, and it is allocated automatically and equally across each of the collections in your database account. So again, subject to that minimum level of 667 request units, or a third of a capacity unit, through to 2,000 request units, one whole capacity unit. If you've only got a single collection in your database and you buy 2 capacity units, you are wasting money. So pretty important to understand those min and max levels. If we consume throughput at a level greater than what we've paid for, we're going to get throttled. And so it's really important to understand this idea of request units. So each capacity unit gives you an ability to execute at a rate of up to 2,000 request units per second. All right, so it is a request units per second metric, and that basically means that given a single capacity unit, you need to keep your throughput at or below 2,000 RUs per second. And it can be a little nuanced because, as we're going to see shortly, the database engine will return to you the request unit cost of operations. But it's not yet returning to you the time boundaries of those operations. Right? And that can make quite a difference. Say you perform an operation that takes 1,000 RUs, but actually it occurs over 4 seconds, right? Then the RU throughput of that operation isn't 1,000 RUs per second, it's 250 RUs per second. Right? So you know, it's going to take a little bit of time to shake all of this out, and certainly some mechanism to make it easier to determine the sort of the start point and end point and sort of the temporal dimension of our operations is going to make it a whole lot easier to do capacity planning. So if we request, if we exceed our reserved throughput level, you're going to get, your session's going to get whacked, right? You're going to get a 429 back, but that 429 is going to carry with it some HTTP headers. And again, this is probably sort of unique among the services at the moment that look like this in Azure, and that's going to send back to you a retry after header. And what that's telling you is please back off the service and retry again in n milliseconds. So that means it's pretty easy if you need to write your own client to write a client that does that whole sort of back off and retry logic. Has anybody written that before? Yeah, for like what, SQL database, Azure storage, something else? Yeah, so often you have to write it yourself, often you have to come up with your own rules to do that. There were some useful application blocks that you can use to help with that. And so if you do need to go out and write your own client library, that's going to be a really important header for you to be able to decide, okay, how do I deal with this back off logic? The .NET Client SDK and several of the others already support this, right? So they look at that response header and they will back off and retry by default three times for that .NET library. And then what you're probably going to want to do is to set up some alerts in the portal that will alert you if you start hitting up against that RU threshold. And one capacity unit actually gets you a ton of throughput. Right, so one capacity unit at preview is like $22.50 a month, so call that at production $45 a month. That gets you a very, very large amount of throughput for a well-designed application. So it's important to understand how you burn through these RUs, and different types of operations against the data store are going to burn through RUs at a different rate. Sort of the min bar on a per request basis is one, right? So at the very minimum, a single request to the service, right? That's a single call to the HTTP endpoint of the RESTful service is going to consume one RU. And that's for the simplest of all operations, which is getting a single document using the underscore self identifier. That's the most efficient way to pull a single document. And we'll talk about how you might use that later. In terms of some other common operations, basic, you know, update, delete, insert is gonna cost you four RUs. Querying a document out of a collection using a simple predicate is gonna cost you a couple of RUs. Executing a stored procedure, right, that goes and does 50 document inserts, so maybe chucking up a big chunk of JSON and then shredding it in a stored procedure, right? That's going to consume 100 RUs. So you can see we actually gain quite a bit of efficiency there. If you compare row number two with row number four by doing these batch-based operations within the context of a stored procedure. So it's important to understand those stored procedures. These are not set in stone numbers. They are rough numbers and they're predicated on a database of the characteristics set out at the bottom of the slide. But it is important to note that these are deterministic mechanisms. So that means given the same database with the same data in it and the same indexing policy, you are going to get consistent results, right? There's no noisy neighbor problems or anything like that are going to interfere with your capacity planning. So in terms of pulling this out, let's have a quick look at how we pull that out. So I've got a tool here, and I'll show you the link for it shortly, called Azure Document DB Studio. And I've got a few collections here. And if I run some queries, I've got a few pulled over here. So here's that simple predicate. If I go and execute that, so that's returned one document. How many request units is that going to consume? Two, fantastic, right? So there it is there. There's that XMS request charge response header being sent back, right? That's telling me it's consuming a couple. Okay, so what if I go and run a similar query, again, looking at the same property to compare, but returning, you know, a larger number of documents. Okay, so I think I returned 4 documents. 1, 2, 3, 4. All right. So I'm getting some efficiencies there, right? It's not just a straight out, you know, multiplication of the RUs for the single predicate comparison. And then if I look at something that uses 2 separate properties, again, returning that single document, you know, you'll see quite a bit more expensive when I want to start doing an OR comparison there, because it's actually going to go and look at 2 points in the index. You know, so really important that you get your head around that. This tool is super useful for just faffing around trying these queries out, and it's worth grabbing a copy of that if you want to. You'll grab the slides or just snap that QR code and go and pull that up. It's a tool that's actually been shipped by the DocDB team, but it's pretty well hidden down in GitHub. So the next thing to talk about is the fact that DocDB is a true schema-free database. Everyone claims to be a schema-free database. The problem is that they then say, you know, we're a schema-free database and we work really well at scale. And to make it work really well at scale, you need to create indexes. And when you create indexes, you are, by implication, creating what? A schema, right? So it's kind of, we're schema free unless you need to run at scale, and we're specifically designed to run at scale, so it's kind of just bullshit, right? So this is a schema free database. Why? Well, because by default, everything is indexed. Anytime you stick a document in there, the whole bloody thing is indexed, right? Which means you have optimized retrieval regardless of what structures you stuff into the database. The storage is schema-free, the index is schema-free, right? If you take just one thing away from today's session, this is the thing to take away. This is the differentiator, right? The differentiator is this is true schema-free because everything is indexed. The index then is not a B-tree. There's a whole lot of magic under the hood, right? Uses some really clever stuff out of Microsoft Research. I'm not allowed to tell you exactly how the hell it works. The team is going to ship some stuff over the next few months. But it's designed to work really well under right pressure. So it is trying to deliver on the promise sort of that's yet to be delivered on in terms of these schema-free databases. So out of the box, it just works. It can't read your mind all of the time, right? It has to make some assumptions when it thinks about indexing everything. So we can change the way that DocumentDB indexes. And we can change that in sort of a very aggressive way, you know, where we basically move away from that pure schema-free into, you know, basically schema-by-implication approach. Or we can sit somewhere in the middle. So what we're doing when we tweak these indexes, we're basically trading off the same sorts of things that we've traded off with indexing in relational land, right? We're trading off write performance. The more indexes we have, right, we get a hit on write performance, we consume more RUs when we write. Right? We're trading off read performance. Again, you know, as a general rule of thumb, the more indexes we've got to work with, the more efficiently we can read data from the database, the less RUs we consume on read. We're trading off storage, right? So when we think about those 10 gigs we get per capacity unit, we consume some space for the document itself, we consume some space for the index. As we tune the index, we change the amount of space that any given document takes because we change the amount of space chewed through by the index. And then we're also trading off complexity and flexibility, right? As we move from that pure schema-free model at one side to the, you know, hard schema defined by our index on the other, you know, we're trading off our ability to just go and stuff stuff in the database and pull it back out easily. And you're going to define different indexing models on different collections, right? And there'll be parts of your app where you say, actually, I want to have a fully structured indexing approach. And there'll be others where you say, actually, I want to have a fully flexible indexing approach. And we'll talk about some of those sort of data design decisions shortly. So how do we manage indexes? We do that through a thing called index policy, and that defines the indexing mechanism at the collection level. It is immutable, and that's really important. It is immutable, so when we create the collection, we define the index policy and we can't change it afterwards. So the idea of sort of incremental index tuning over time, that doesn't really exist within the context of DocumentDB at the moment. We can set an indexing mode to be either consistent or lazy. Consistent means as we write the data, the document, the index is written at the same time. We have lazy, that means as we write the document gets written, and at some point in the future, a background process is going to write our indexes and basically mean that queries are going to then resolve that document. We can then choose how we want the indexing to occur. So we can specify the automatic property to be true. That means every time we write a document, it automatically gets added into the index. Or we can set automatic to be false. That means anytime we add a document, it's not necessarily going to be indexed unless we set an indexing directive when we put the document. Now you think, why on earth would I want to do that? Well, there'll be situations where you're storing a range of different document types in one collection, and you want some of those documents to be indexed, and you want some of them to go nowhere near the index because you're only ever going to hit them by that self-link, right? So, you know, you need to start thinking about approaching these applications in a different way than what you would, you know, back in relational land, right? So in some cases you'll opt into the index, and in some cases you won't. If it's not indexed, the only way to get it out is by the underscore self-link, right? The next thing we specify in our policy is to include and exclude specific paths within our document. So this is starting to really define schema by defining indexes. So we can include specific paths, we can then exclude subpaths within those included paths, or we can exclude specific paths. And remember, this applies to the whole collection. Right? So you need to keep that in the back of your mind when you're thinking about storing different types of documents within one collection. We then specify the index type, so by default, that automatic indexing uses hash indexes. Hash indexes are really good for pulling out point values. We can specify that we want it to use range indexes for some paths. We can specify that actually we want it to do hash indexes and range indexes across the entire corpus of documents in the collection. Right, that means that we'll be as good at doing point lookups as we are at doing range lookups across all documents, but it means we're trading off some write time RUs, right, and we're also trading off the amount of storage we're going to consume. And then we can also specify precision, which is basically the amount of the property that's used as part of the index. And again, that's going to affect storage overhead and RUs consumed at write time. So let's have a quick look at this. So I've got three collections here, and they each have a slightly different indexing policy. So this sessions one has the default indexing policy, so you'll see it's set automatic to true, indexing mode is consistent. It's going to apply a hash index with a precision of numeric precision, a string precision of 3 across the root path and all subpaths, and then it's going to apply a range index with a precision of 6 across the underscore TS path, which is the timestamp path used for basically pulling a range of documents out by timestamp. Then we've got another one that I've defined where I've basically changed the precision. So again, it's using automatic and consistent indexing, but in this case, I've dropped the string precision on the effectively the sort of the all paths index specification down to 1. The last one, I've set the indexing mode to lazy. So let's run some queries against these and see just what happens. So I've got a document here, and I'm going to add that document into that first one. This has got the default indexing policy. Okay, so that's consumed 24.5 RUs to stuff that document in. The second policy has a lower precision on the string hash indexes. Who thinks this is going to use less RUs? Who thinks it's going to use more RUs? Who's completely undecided? Okay, so it's going to use less RUs. Why? Well, because we are asking it to write a smaller amount of data on that big catch-all index, right? So the last one was 24.5. This one saves us a little bit down to 23.5, right? You know, so again, you know, not a huge amount. What about this lazy one? Is that going to use more RUs? Less RUs? Heaps less RUs, right? Let's run that up. So again, we were 23 last time. This is down to 7. Heaps less RUs. The really neat thing about this is this effectively means we're not paying for those request units. Why? Well, because we're not actually using them sort of in real time as we execute against the database. Now, that may change, but it does give us an option if we're prepared to have, you know, a long period of time between when we go and insert the data and we want to go and pull the data out. Turning on lazy indexing could be quite useful. So the question is, what is a long period of time? TBD, non-deterministic at the moment. You know, I would say I would allow hours. All right, but again, it's not documented, and I've not billy-goated around inside it to try and sort of reverse engineer exactly how it's working. But I will take an action to try and find out if they've got any sort of determinism around that, and I'll bang it on Twitter if I do manage to find out. So follow me on Twitter, I'll try and find that in the next sort of 24, 48 hours. Okay, let's talk a bit about polyglotism. So that's the idea that most of these sort of modern cloud applications that we build are going to use a number of different data stores. So effectively, when we build an application, we're bolting together a bunch of different data stores based on the sort of the characteristics and the strengths and weaknesses of each of those technologies. And so the idea was coined by this guy, who's a guy called Martin Fowler. You might know him from a book called Design Patterns. And that book's actually well worth reading. So called NoSQL Distilled, but basically it sets out the characteristics of a range of different NoSQL style data stores, and it's showing its age a little bit, you know, in that there are sort of newer implementations of some of those NoSQL type patterns. But it should give you a pretty good idea of the different capabilities, different strengths and weaknesses of the various types of stores. Inside Azure, you know, we've got a bunch of different stores. This probably misses a few things like Redis. You know, you'd argue whether Redis is a pure cache or maybe a store in and of itself. But you're probably going to end up with, you know, two or more of these different stores inside your application. They all have different strengths and weaknesses, right? You know, so SQL Server and a VM, we've got full control over that. It's fully fledged SQL Server. It's got, you know, 40 years of relational database history and capability, but we kind of got to deal with it and manage it and you know, run it ourselves. It's not got a flexible schema. We have to define schema a priori and so forth. We've got things like blobs, right? Super cheap storage, super simple storage, right? Completely schema free, totally arbitrary, but we don't get higher, you know, high level characteristics such as programmability and things. You know, DocumentDB sort of marries many of the strengths of the sort of the ends of the spectrum. You know, we do have programmability, we do have a schema-free data model, it is fully managed as a service and so forth. And so DocDB understands this idea of polyglotism, understands that you're probably going to want to use multiple data stores, understands that you probably don't want to store megabytes and megabytes of images inside the really expensive, comparatively expensive storage that DocDB provides. So it has a mechanism called attachments that lets us basically store blobs and media that are associated with our documents into outside storage. And you've got a couple of options there. One is to have DocumentDB manage the whole life cycle, in which case you submit the image up to the DocumentDB REST service, and it takes that, sucks it out, drops it into blob storage. You get a couple of gigs per database account at the moment, and then it manages the life cycle for us. Right? So it will basically, when we create the document, add the attachment, right? We can then retrieve that attachment back out by referring to it underneath the document. But if we go and delete the document, it will go and delete the attachment out of blob storage, right? So it fully manages that lifecycle for us, which we'd otherwise have to deal with ourselves. Or we can self-manage. So if you want to use something other than blob storage, say you want to stick it in SharePoint Online or in, you know, Dropbox or something else, then DocDB will give you a mechanism to store the metadata about that attachment, but you will be down to having to manage that life cycle yourself. And you'll probably do that using things like triggers and journaling tables that we'll talk about shortly. We're going to run out of time if I do a demo, so I'm just going to let you look at that when you grab the code. I'll chuck that up in a little while. So what we need to think about when we're thinking about, you know, how do we arrange this sort of multi-headed monster of data stores is are things like, you know, how much storage am I going to use? Where's it going to live? What does it cost? Right? You know, it's always possible to build a more efficient implementation, but usually that comes at a cost of having to do a whole lot of work to sort of manage the multi-headed monster. So we're often trading, you know, a bit of cost at operations time against some, you know, additional investment at build time to come up with a more sophisticated model. You know, how are you going to index that data? You know, how much entropy do we have in our data to make available to the indexing mechanism? Are we ever going to query it? Should I exclude it? Right. If I exclude it, should I exclude it just from the index or from the entire document and maybe push that out into an attachment? If I push it out into an attachment, I've suddenly bought into the idea that to get the whole document, including the content I've pushed into an attachment, I'm now making multiple network calls. And network calls are a really expensive operation in terms of latency, you know, for these applications. So, you know, that's something we probably need to consider, you know, pretty carefully, you know, when we think about having lots and lots of network calls required to get the whole piece of data for our application. And indeed, we need to think about where are those network calls going to come from. Right? If we think about attachments at the moment, attachments in DocDB, if DocDB is managing them, I go and fetch them through the DocDB RESTful service. DocDB's got them in blob storage, managing them for me, and it's effectively, you know, proxying them to me. What would be potentially nice is if I can manage them myself inside blob storage and return down a shared access signature when I pull the document back so that I can potentially hand that down to the client. The client could go and fetch those directly using the shared access signature. It's certainly a piece of feedback I've given to the team. You know, effectively, I love this lifecycle stuff. I don't like the fact that you have to proxy the calls for me because I've got to pay RUs for you to go and do that fetch from blob storage. Let me get the document, let me get the attachments, let me get a shared access signature with some parameters that I define in my request, and then I can send the client directly to that shared access signature to go and fetch it from blob storage. Right? So this is all about trading that complexity of implementation for a more efficient, more optimized operational model. One of the things that you're almost certain to hit when you think about modeling data for these systems is whether you embed subcontent within the document or whether you reference subcontent as links to a separate document. Right? Think of this as the product manufacturer or order lines type of problem. So when we think about embedding, that's really well suited to things like containment. You know, typically where we are well bounded in terms of that relationship, so one to a few. We were dealing with slowly changing data. Right? Why? Well, because if we want to go and change the data, we've got to update that whole document, right? Because document updates inside DocDB occur at the whole document level. If we want to do many-to-many, we are going to be managing duplicates. To a relational person, the idea of managing duplicates is kind of anathema, right? It's probably the most no-go area of no-go areas of, you know, I'm totally all over normalization, I would never duplicate data. Well, actually, in NoSQL land, you duplicate data a hell of a lot of the time, right? And that's just some of the complexity that you buy into to take advantage of the benefits. Right? The benefits, one read to the service pulls back all of our data. The downside, if we want to change anything, we're probably going to have to perform multiple writes. And at the very least, we're going to have to write the whole document. If we reference, you know, effectively you can think of this as like third normal form in document land. I kind of hate the term normalize being applied here, because to me normalize has very sort of relational connotations. But if you're a relational person, think of it as third normal form. And that lets us do many-to-many without having to deal with duplicates. It lets us easily do unbounded one-to-many's. Right? It does mean if we want to get the whole document, including all the reference stuff, we're going to be making multiple calls across the network, subject to maybe doing some optimization in JavaScript and actually writing, you know, something that looks a bit more like a parameterized view that goes and does the multiple calls server side. The benefit is that when we want to do a write to update any of that reference content, we can update just the reference content and have to update the whole document. When we think about relations, you know, you could use your own unique identifier, right? Your human readable identifier through that relationship, which means that any retrieval is going to be a simple predicate query, which is going to chew through how many request units? Two. Or you could use the self link, right, which is going to chew through how many request units, right? So basically, if you're going to use ID, you have expensive tastes, right? Because it's going to cost you twice as much at scale. So, you know, really important to think about that. Also need to think about, you know, the directionality of these relationships. And that's really thinking, you know, where is the unbounded growth occurring? So if you think about, say, relating manufacturer and product, you know, if we reference the products out of manufacturer, right, every time we add a new product, we're going to have to go and update manufacturer. It's probably a real pain in the neck, yeah? Because products are effectively unbounded. If we go the other way and reference manufacturer out of product, a whole lot easier, right? The only time we have to update the product is if the manufacturer changes. The two are kind of coupled together. You know, they're tightly bounded. There may be some scenarios where we want to do both. So the canonical polyglot persistence scenario is an online store, right? If you've ever played with this stuff, you've probably seen an online store scenario. So let's talk about the data requirements for an online store. You might have something that looks a little like this. Let's go through them in turn. Okay, so name, pretty bloody simple. You probably want to search that. It's probably sufficient to have a hash index. You may want to duplicate that into another richer indexing mechanism, say something like Azure Search. And we have a cool sample app coming soon that you'll be able to grab that shows you some of this in action. SKU, so SKU's really important in these cataloging applications. So say we have a SKU that's represented something like, you know, year, the year that the product was added, a three character category code, and then some sort of unique identifier, right? You know, we almost certainly want to index that, but the question is, how do we go about indexing that, right? If we think about precision there, we've kind of got the entropy in the wrong place. What do I mean by that? Right, the entropy is at that end of the value, right? Whereas I really want it at this end of the value. So some options there, we could store it reverse, so basically flip it, right? If we do that, we're kind of buying into the fact that we need to deal with it flipped inside our application. Another option is we could store it reversed and store it normally and exclude the normal translation from been indexed. We may want to say pull out the year and put a range index on that, or even just put a range index across the non-translated representation of the data. Is this making sense to everybody? And then this is not new, right? We've had reversed indexes inside relational databases and things for a while. Description, HTML up to 8K. We probably don't want to index that inside DocDB, right? Because our index is really only looking at that first bit of the content. We probably do want it to be indexed. We'd probably push that into something like Azure Search. Do we want to save space and maybe pull that out of the core document and include it as an attachment? Now, that's really a trade-off around, do I want to save the space in DocDB? If I do that, I'm buying into having to make two network calls to get the content back out again. It's a trade-off, but would almost certainly exclude that from the index. What about things like price? Well, so if we think about price, we might want to have a rich, complex type defining price, including some currency information, like a base currency. The currency probably doesn't change a lot, right? Countries don't change currencies very often. Scotland almost did. They decided better of it. So we can probably get away with managing the duplication of data by pushing currency information, at least, the definitions into the product itself. The challenge then comes when we think about, what are we going to do around search? If we're defining a base currency, then we're probably wanting to do things like on-the-fly currency currency conversions. If we start thinking about that and want to push the data up into Windows, into Microsoft Azure Search, we're going to have to keep that updated. We're going to have to keep that consistent. If we go and change currency rates, we're going to need to go and update all of the products inside Search. And we start running into consistency problems, and that's the big problem you run into when you think about NoSQL data stores generally and polyglot persistence broadly, is dealing with consistency, right? Because you're managing the consistency yourself. Images are obviously going to go into attachments, right? Probably lifecycle managed attachments, but maybe we want to manage those ourselves. Things like reviews, right? So reviews, do we embed them? Do we reference them? If we reference them, are we going to reference them on product? Or are we going to reference them on review? Or are we going to reference them on both? We could embed and reference, right? So one idea might be that we embed the most recent 10 reviews into the product so that when we grab product and send it down to be rendered client-side and say using an MVVM toolkit, right, we get the whole data set, including the most recent 10 reviews. And then if we want more, we go back to the server and make a call to some reference data to go and get more, right? Again, we're dealing with duplication, right? We're always curating our consistency, and we have lots of background processes managing consistency. We are taking advantage of these different types of data storage mechanisms to build an optimized app. Anybody doing something like that at the moment? One down the back. Attributes. So this, I think, is where it gets really interesting. This, I think, is where it's really important to remember back to that one thing I said at the start, which is this is a true schema-free database, because this is really where we see these document databases shine. So I've got some JSON here, and this is a representation of those products. And the thing I'm most interested in having a look at is down here, which are these product attributes. Anybody into mountain biking? A few people into mountain biking. I'm quite into mountain biking, right? So when you think about, buying a mountain bike, it can be quite a complex decision-making process. The information that we might want to represent about a mountain bike can be very, very complex and can be quite hierarchical. So here you'll see we've got these product attributes, and these are going into the database strongly typed. Right, material, carbon fiber, great, it's a string value. Weight, right, 3,320 grams. Right, the cool thing here is that's going into the database searchable, right, as strongly typed data. Now, a little challenge there is that's obviously been hash indexed and not range indexed at the moment. So when we think about this sort of super flexible attributes model I'm sort of talking about, we would probably go and adjust our indexing policy. So we'd slap a hash index on the forward slash and all subpaths, and a range index on the forward slash and all subpaths. Right? We'd buy into a bit more RU usage at update time, because we don't update the products all that often. And we'd probably buy into a bit more storage usage to get the benefits of being able to do stuff like this, right? So now we might have the drivetrain, right, which in turn becomes an array of additional complex subtypes, right? Where we have things like, you know, cranks, and we might want to go further. We could then define, say, within the crank set, we could define chain rings and additional complex types. And all of this ends up being rich, structured data stored, indexed, and therefore efficiently retrievable in our data store. Has anybody tried to do this in relational land? Has anybody done this in XML land? Right? This is a very, very hard problem to solve, because you're basically looking for, I want an infinitely flexible data model where I completely pull, right, the knowledge about data structure out of my my data store. So that's really the promise of schema-free, right? The promise of schema-free are these infinitely complex, tight structures stored, indexed in my data store. And then I can keep the knowledge about those structures somewhere else, and I can use that knowledge to do things like dynamically build search forms, dynamically build rendering mechanisms, so I could have some other stuff stored that knows how to render a crank set and the properties of a crank set, that knows how to allow users to search on a crank set. So find me mountain bikes with crank sets that are made of carbon fiber that have chain rings of at least 140 millimeters and use a BCD bolt pattern of 110 mil. Right. That is basically impossible to do in relational land, because you are tying yourself in normalized knots. Right. Everything sort of gets normalized, and you've got the problem of different types when you have your normalization. Just becomes a complete nightmare. So this is what you're buying when you buy into document databases. You're buying this ability to have infinitely flexible data models. I'm not going to jump into those links, but go have a look at them, right? Things like material safety data sheets. Really good candidates for this. We built a system for toxins, which is our New Zealand National Poison Centre, that contains complex chemical information. It's all XML based. We don't quite have this mechanism yet. Right? If we had this 10 years ago, it'd be absolutely fantastic, because we could then do tight retrieval of this data. Let's briefly discuss data tier programmability. DocDB has programmability. Some people are going to love it, some people are going to hate it. You don't have to use it. That said, it's very, very useful. We have stored procedures, we have triggers, we have user-defined functions. Each call that we make to the service gets wrapped in an atomic, consistent, isolated, and durable transaction. All right. If we throw an exception within our JavaScript, we roll back that transaction. Really useful to be able to do things like push up a bunch of JSON and shred it on the server side, drop it into multiple documents, right? Single network call. Equally, make a single call to the service and have it pull together a number of documents to then be returned back down to the client. It is sandboxed, you are restricted. There are no imports, so if you need to do things like, you know, some cool date work, you're going to need to basically use cut and paste reuse to make that happen. There are no outbound network calls, right? So, you know, there are some things that you probably want to do, like using journaling tables to go and update other data stores. You need to do that using your own background processes. You can't use eval. You are going to be resource governed and time bound. So where would you use this programmability? Key thing, reduce network calls, right? So send multiple documents up, shred them into the database. Do transforms and joins, make a single call, have it transform your data, join it together, send you back a projection of data that suits your application requirements. multi-document transactions, have stuff that needs to succeed or fail atomically, right, this is the way to do it. Push up a big chunk of JSON, process it and shred it on the service tier. Right? If you are anti data tier programmability, you are going to bump into some challenges here. Right? You're going to pay some network latency costs. Also use it to drive lazy processes, right? So buying into polyglot persistence is buying into managing your consistency yourself. Right? You are going to need to have background processes that take data, insert it into DocDB, write out some information to a journaling table, and then go and use that journaling information to go and update other data stores to mean that you always achieve eventual consistency. Right? With polyglot persistence, you really only ever have eventual consistency. Which brings us to talking a bit about consistency, and we'll move through this reasonably quickly. I'm not going to give you a deep dive on replicated data consistency. There's a great paper by Doug Terry from MSR on this. And in fact, you'll see many of the ideas that he talks about coming out inside DocDB. DocDB has tunable consistency. So we're talking here about the consistency of the multiple replicas we use to store your data in the data center and keep it durable. The consistency levels that you choose are specified at the account level, and then you can weaken those for read operations only. The levels you're going to choose from, strong consistency. So strong consistency means when you write data, it is going to be written synchronously to a quorum of replicas. Once we have a quorum, we can return and say, okay, we're happy, and update any remaining replicas asynchronously. When we do reads under strong consistency, we read from a quorum. We need to get the same value back from a quorum of nodes. That means that we've got that strongly consistent value. We support bounded staleness, right? That basically means that, you know, we use async replication, right? So we are weakly consistent at write time, but at read time, right, we choose a quorum of reads, but we can specify that we're happy to take data that is N seconds out of date or N operations out of date. The default is session consistency. Session consistency is pretty cool, right? Because session consistency kind of gives you what you really want, which is read your own writes, right? If I go and write some data to the database, right, and I go and read that data back from the database, I get annoyed if it's different to what I just wrote, right? So really important that I don't get phantom reads. But actually, for everybody else, they can deal with eventually consistent, right? You know, for the rest of the users of my application, eventually consistent is fine as long as I can read my own writes. So, you know, session consistency gives you that. Async replication, so fast, low latency writes, right? Session bound reads means that I get to read my own writes. And then we have eventual consistency, which means all bets are off. We write asynchronously, we read asynchronously, you may get, you know, dirty reads. So, in summary, we have deep dived and we are about on time. I've skipped a couple of demos. That code is going to be available on my Twitter sometime soon. So you'll be able to pull it down and have a look. It's commented, all that sort of blah, blah. It's nice and simple. It's about, you know, a couple of hundred lines. DocDB is a preview service. Expect it to change over time. Enjoy the fact that it is changing and improving over time. Give feedback to the team. They are listening. Think outside the relational model. If all you're trying to do is map your relational data schema into DocDB, you're going to tie yourselves in knots and get all of the downsides and none of the upsides. Right? You really need to think about how can I buy into that true schema-free model for both data and the indexes. And as I said, the demo code is going to go at CAULD on Twitter and in the Yammer group really shortly. With that, I'll open the floor to some questions and maybe some answers. Yeah.
Is the attachment and document management around the attachment, is that part of the same transaction and guarantee?
Yep. So the question was, you're talking about attachments before. Is the attachment part of the transaction? So the answer is yes, subject to me needing to go and do a little bit of digging around exactly how it deals with the content inside blob storage. But I would say, you know, absolutely the document and the attachment and attachment metadata within a single transaction. I just need to go and dig on the blob, but I would be 99% sure that it's going to deal with the cleanup if it decides to roll back that transaction. So yes, bounded within the same transaction. More questions, folks? Is there any geo support? So the question is there any geo support? I assume you're asking about geo types. So at the moment there is not geo support. Yep. So the question was you showed some T-SQL earlier. Is that read only? And the answer is at the moment, I'm pretty sure it's read only. I'm pretty sure that the writes just have to be a plain old put of the document into the store. Time's up, I gotta bail. I am gonna go and hang out. I'm sure there's a lounge somewhere through here, and I'll happily take some more questions offline. Thanks for all having me. Please do your evals.